After such a wonderful introduction, I can hardly wait to hear what I have to say. If I may, I would like to take you on a trip tonight. Over the past 50, 60, maybe 70 years of Jewish life in this country. The rabbi said a great rule, Ein balanes makir beniso. A person to whom miracles occur never recognizes the miracle. That was true generally of the Jewish people. I feel that that's really the best description of the Jewish world today, that the Jewish people just don't recognize the miracle that God has wrought for us. Many years ago, when I was a rabbi in Miami Beach, so the great sainted Ponovizhia Rav, Rabbi Yosef Kahaneman, would come to winter in Miami Beach, and he would come to collect money for the yeshiva. He'd spend 3 months there, and I was his driver. I was the chauffeur. We'd go 3 mornings a week for two and a half hours to collect money for the yeshiva. To me, it was a almost a turning point in my life to be with such a great person and to benefit from his wisdom and guidance, and also to become somewhat of the practitioner of the art of extracting money from Jews, which is a most necessary talent in order to be a builder of the Jewish people. They say the great Rabbi Meir Shapiro, when he built the yeshiva in Lublin, so he was short about $100,000 to finish the building. So he went to the bank in Warsaw and he asked for a loan. And the banker said to him, as all bankers say, Rabbi, what's your collateral? He said, I'm collateral. He says, I don't need collateral. I have all the money. So the banker said to him, Rabbi, if you have all the money, then why do you come to me for the loan? He said, I have all the money, but it's still in the pockets of the Jews of Warsaw. I have to get it out of them. So we would travel up and down the causeway of Miami Beach and visit people. So I remember that we once came to a Jew, and the Jew gave us a nice donation. And then he unloaded a whole bunch of complaints about the Jewish people, complaints about the Torah world, complaints about the state of Israel. You know, there always are complaints. And then finally, in exasperation, he said to the Ponovizhia Rav, he said, Rebbe, is the glass half empty or is it half full? And the Rav looked at him in the eyes and he said, you mean there's a glass? And that really is what we have to consider, that there's a glass. 60 years ago, the Jewish people were on the floor. A third of the Jewish people had been destroyed. The gates of Palestine then were sealed shut. There were 250,000 Jewish refugees in Europe that nobody wanted. When Harry Truman asked the British government to allow 100,000 Jews to enter then Palestine under the British mandate, Ernest Bevin's remark was, he wants them in Palestine because he doesn't want them in Brooklyn. And when the survivors began to come to trickle to the United States, I remember as a small child in Chicago, I remember a family that came, I mean, they came with nothing. I remember my mother of blessed memory gave away our dining room set to one of the families because they had nothing and we had a kitchen set. And from then on, we ate in the kitchen. And they never said a word as to what happened to them. Last night I had supper in Memphis, Tennessee. Today's Wednesday, it's Philadelphia. And there was a survivor that was at the supper. And he told me, he said, Yom Kippur, 1946. He's in this DP camp. And the American soldiers, the American Army, set up a service, Yom Kippur service. They brought in a Jewish chaplain. He said there were 2,000 Jewish men in the camp. 7 came to the davening Yom Kippur. Who believed anymore? And yet, there was a certain indomitable spirit within the Jewish people. And the measure of a people is what happens afterwards. We're not the only people in the world who have suffered a genocide. But we're the only people in the world who, after suffering genocide, somehow pick ourselves up off the floor and continue as though nothing happened. That's the strength of Israel, the strength of the Jewish people. Anyone who has visited the old city of Jerusalem, when you walk down to the Kotel, so then you are walking through what is called the Armenian Quarter, the part of the old city that is inhabited by Armenian Christians. Now, 1.5 million Armenians were slaughtered by the Turks in the First World War. So they have their signs, the Armenian genocide, which is tragic, and the world ignores it. And the Turks keep on denying that it ever happened. But what always strikes me is 60 years afterwards, so where are the Armenians? So now what? Whereas the Jewish people have always had within themselves this strength to be able to rebuild themselves. The rabbis teach us, we just finished Pesach, the rabbis teach us that in the Gemara Pesachim, that women are obligated and children are obligated to drink the 4 cups of wine and to recite the message of the Haggadah because She'af Heim Hoyu Boso Anes. They also were in the miracle. So there are 2 interpretations that are given. The Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Meir, in his commentary to Pesachim, says that it's because of the women that the miracle occurred. Because of as the Midrash teaches us, the men in Egypt gave up. They divorced their wives, they gave up, they didn't want to have any children anymore. They said, what use is there to have children and have them mortared into the walls? They simply gave up. The women did not give up. And the women put a great deal of effort. They literally seduced their husbands. And they were rewarded that their mirrors and their cosmetics were used in the construction of the Holy Tabernacle. Because they believed that somehow the redemption would come. So the Rashbam says that they were the ones that created the miracle, so therefore certainly they should drink the 4 cups of wine and recite the Haggadah. Tosfos, the students of the Rashbam, disagree with their teacher. There's no greater joy in life than for a parent or a grandparent or a teacher to have a son or a grandson or a student disagree with you in Torah matters. There's a famous story about Rabbeinu Tam, who is another grandson of Rashi. So there was a rabbi in Orleans, in France, who had a particular ruling, and he ruled against Rashi's opinion. So Rabbeinu Tam sent him a letter, and he said to him, "How dare you disagree with the great master of French Jewry, with Rashi?" So the rabbi wrote him back, and he said, "Me?" He said, "You disagree with him all the time." And Rabbeinu Tam wrote him back, and he said, "Listen, he's my grandfather, not yours. My grandfather I can disagree with, but who are you?" So the Balei Tosfos said the Rashbam is incorrect, because the language, "af heim hoyu bosa anes," they also were in the miracle, that language does not imply that they were the ones that created the miracle. It only implies that they are somehow secondary to the miracle. So therefore Tosfos says, because they were included in the miracle, they were part of it. Because if we would not have gotten out of Egypt, the women would have been abused and destroyed. And therefore that's what their responsibility. So I've always thought that there are two levels in the miracle. There are people who create the miracle, and there are people who are part of the miracle. All of the Jewish people are part of the miracle. But there are people who create the miracle. And in American Jewry, there were people who created the miracle, who did not give up, who did not say, "But this is America." I grew up on a block in Chicago, all Jewish neighborhood, in the Lawndale neighborhood on Douglas Boulevard. I had 100, literally 100 friends, boys. I was the only Sabbath observer. My friends used to come knocking on the door Shabbos afternoon and say, "Well, you know, we're going to the ball game, can Beryl come with us, or we want to play, we're going to a movie." My mother, who is a very formidable woman, would say, "He's not coming." And Beryl wanted to come. I'm 8 years old, 9 years old. Who doesn't want to go to the ball game? When I'm the only one in the whole block. But it didn't happen, because I went to public school. With no Jewish school then. I have my great Rabbi Twersky story that I have to share with you. Is that I was riding in a car with Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky. He's one of the few people left who is older than I am. And he went to the yeshiva in Chicago that I went to. He was a few years ahead of me. And he turned to me in the car and he said, "Beryl," he said, "you know, you and I, we have a very good secular education because we went to public school." So I said, "That's right, you know, we went to public school." And in the car were two very noted Rosh Yeshiva. I mean, top level. And one of them turned around and he said, "I also went to public school." So Twersky looks at him as only Twersky can. And he said, "Well, if you say so, you know, I'll accept your word." Even though he doesn't speak English anymore. And but then the second one turned around and he also said, "I went to public school." Now this was beyond our belief. So Twersky says, "I don't believe you." He says, "What do you mean you don't believe me? I'm telling you, I went to public school." So Twersky says, "To improve it, sing Silent Night." And that's the truth. We can all sing Silent Night. Off key, but we can sing it. And that was the society. We were 200 boys in the yeshiva. That was all Chicago. And we really didn't see a future for ourselves. We were there because our parents wanted us to be there. We were there because we loved the teachers that we had, who were all Europeans. The glory of Eastern Europe, especially of Lithuania and Eastern Europe. The Talmud says that Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the great Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi, the editor of the Mishnah, was once asked why he was so great. And he answered, because he saw the back of Rabbi Meir. He said, if I would have seen him face to face, I would be greater. My generation saw the back of Eastern European Jewry. We saw the last. It's not to denigrate, God forbid, what we have and what we've accomplished. But whatever that was is no longer here. It took 1,000 years to make it, and it was destroyed in 5. But that description of being a human being that was Eastern European Jewry, that's not here. But we saw no future for ourselves. And 2 people changed our view. I just, I'm being personal because I want to tell you the story in a microcosm, and then you'll expand it and understand what happened here. In fact, Dr. Kasky was kind enough to refer to the fact that I'm still a member of the Illinois Bar. The reason that I went to law school, our family are generations rabbis. But the reason I went to law school is because my father and I both believed that there was not going to be an Orthodox rabbinate left in America. And I was not going to be a non-Orthodox rabbi, and no one had told me the secret yet that there are fathers who are willing to pay you to marry their daughters. It was a different world. And so, you know, I had to put bread on the table, so I went to law school and became a lawyer. And then the Lord took me by the scruff of the neck, and he pulled me out, and he made me a rabbi again. But that's a different story. But in any event, we really didn't see a future. And then we were visited by 2 people in the yeshiva. One was Rabbi Dr. Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was the chief rabbi then of Palestine, the first chief rabbi of Israel, who was a great, great scholar, pious Jew, PhD from Cambridge, formerly the chief rabbi of Dublin, Ireland. I remember we all went to the airport, to the Midway Airport in Chicago, to greet him. And he came down, it was the first time in my life I saw an airplane up close. He came down the stairway with his majestic top hat, the great silver beard. In one hand, he held the Tanakh. He never traveled without it. And in the other hand, he had the great rabbinic cane with a silver handle, the aristocracy of it. I can still see him in front of me. And he came to the yeshiva, and we all sat down, and he lectured to us on a Talmudic subject for 45 minutes. I even remember the inyan that he spoke about. Ein shliach v'dvar aveir, I remember. And when it was in, that was in Yiddish. And then when he finished, he began to speak to us in English. And I remember how incongruous it was to hear this great Irish brogue come out of his silver beard. And he said as follows. He said, young men, I want to talk to you. I want you to remember what I'm going to say. He said, I want you to remember it 50 years from now. It's more than 50 years for me. He said, I just came back. This is 1946. He said, I have just returned from an audience with Pope Pius XII in Rome. The Catholic Church has got a lot of free publicity over the past few months. That always has to be seen in perspective. He said, and I gave the Pope a list. And on the list were 10,000 names of Jewish children who were entrusted to Catholic churches, monasteries, nunneries, schools, institutions in Europe by their parents in order that they should be saved from the Holocaust. And I asked him to give me the children. And the Pope told me that he would not give me one of them, and that someone who was baptized in the Catholic faith, as all Jewish children who entered the monasteries were, could not be given to be raised in a different faith. And therefore he refused to honor my request. As he said that, he put his head down on the lectern and he wept. I'd never seen a grown man weep like that. The whole Holocaust came pouring out of him. And then he raised himself like a lion. And he looked around the room and he said, I can't do anything for those 10,000 children. Well, what are you going to do for the Jewish people? What are you going to do to rebuild us? It's up to you. And then later, when we all walked by him to shake his hand, and he blessed each of us individually, he said to each and every one of us, did you hear what I said? Do you remember what I said? It was an electric moment, because Rabbi Herzog, with his few words, created people who over the last 50 or 60 years have built Torah institutions throughout the Jewish world. Over 30 of them became leading rabbonim. Over 30 of them became Rosh Yeshiva. There are at least 7 yeshivas that I can name in Israel that were founded by people who were in that room. There are at least 6 girls' seminaries in Israel that are run by people who were in that room. And I want to tell you that being a rabbi for the Jewish people has its moments. Jewish people are a tough people. We wouldn't be here if we weren't a tough people. And because they can't fight with their wives, they take it out on their rabbi. And there were days that, I'd give you the whole thing back for a nickel and give you change. But every time I felt even a moment of depression, of frustration, I heard Rabbi Herzog in my ear. And I felt better. I felt I was doing the right thing. I was in the right place. That's why God put me here. And that remains with me until today. And then a year later, we had a visit from Rabbi Kahaneman from the Ponovizhia Rov. It came in 1947. So in 1947, the Irgun and the Lehi were mounting their campaign to drive Britain, England, out of the land of Israel. And there were all sorts of incidents that were unpleasant. The King David Hotel was blown up. The British hanged a number of Irgun and Lehi young men. In retaliation, the Irgun hanged 2 British sergeants that they kidnapped. There were no hangings after that anymore. And who knew what was going to happen? Jerusalem was cut off already. There was nothing to eat or drink. we don't recognize the miracle, right? When I first came to the State of Israel in 1967, there wasn't a tomato in the country. And then when Moshe Dayan, the agricultural minister, began with his program that they should have tomatoes, vegetables, so the first year the tomatoes were so small and green that the Jewish people, in honor of the occasion, used to call them meshalach. And today you come to the land of Israel, it's the Garden of Eden. Every word of the prophets is fulfilled in front of our eyes. And we take it for granted. It's supposed to be that way. It's not supposed to be that way. It's the miracle. So he came, the Pontifex Rav came. And I remember this year that he said, and all the rabbis in Chicago came to hear him and everything. And then when he finished the shiur, he said, I want to talk to you. Just like Rabbi Herzog, except he didn't speak in English, he spoke in Yiddish. He said as follows. He said, I want you to know that currently in jail in Jerusalem, in the Russian compound, are 17 Jews who are determined to throw England out of the land of Israel. He says, I want you to know that those 17 Jews will throw the English out of the land of Israel. He said, if I had 17 Jews who had the same devotion and sacrifice to build Torah in the land of Israel, we would have a Torah state in the land of Israel. Those were his words. He was a prophet. When he built the yeshiva in Bnei Brak, so they said to him, he told me many times stories how he, when he started, so he started the yeshiva in 1941. Rommel is at El Alamein. The Italian Air Force, people don't even realize, the Italian Air Force bombed Tel Aviv once a week. It was lucky it was the Italian Air Force. But it was real bombs. So they said to him, what are you building a yeshiva for? What? In 10 days, Rommel is here. So he said that he told them, he said two things. He said, first of all, Rommel is not coming. And secondly, even if he is coming, don't we need a yeshiva for 10 days? So those were the people that built. Those were the people that had that view, who saw the picture. One of my favorite statements is that you have to get it. And if you don't get it, a great deal of the Jewish world just doesn't get it. If you don't get it, then it's very hard to explain to you. He told me, and it remains the custom until today, that on Yom HaAtzmaut in Bnei Barak, the yeshiva, Pontifex yeshiva, flies the Israeli flag from the roof of the yeshiva. So when the moral squad came to visit him and said, you know, in Bnei Brak, to fly the Israeli flag, Yom HaAtzmaut. So he said, what did I tell them, Rabbi Wein? I said, I don't know, Rabbi, what you told them. Can't imagine what you told them. He said, I told them very simply. He said, when the yeshiva was in Lithuania, on Lithuanian Independence Day, we flew the Lithuanian flag from the top of the yeshiva. In Yiddish, he said, "Da is nit erger." It is not worse here. the Jews that fly, you know, the American flag on the 4th of July, it's not worse for us there. You have to see it in the picture. In the United States, there was a Jew by the name of Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, who refused to call himself a rabbi, so he became famous as Mr. Mendelovich. You would call him rabbi, he would say Mr. Of course, in Muncie, every plumber is listed in the phone book as rabbi. When I moved to Muncie a long time ago, so then a Rockland phone company, then it was New York Bell, I think, had a policy that they gave a 25% discount on the telephone to all clergy. So in the phone book, I was in rabbis living in Muncie. So I was the only rabbi. I'm an iconoclast, so I'm the only rabbi. I just put myself in this barrel of wine, right? So everybody knew I was a rabbi. So he was Mr. Mendelovitz. And Mr. Mendelovitz raised a generation of disciples that he sent all over the United States to found Jewish day schools. I can't describe to you the struggle for Jewish day schools in the 1940s and 1950s. I remember when the yeshiva in Chicago finally opened a high school, so my parents naturally sent me to the yeshiva high school. The finest Jews in Chicago came to my parents. I was witness to it, and they would say, "You're going to make him a cripple." How can you do that to him? It took the Jewish federations almost 40 years to understand that if we're not for the day schools, they have no future whatsoever. It was un-American. You're against the public school system. And those stronger supporters of the public school system in the United States than the non-Orthodox Jewish community. It's almost a fetish. I mean, they send their children to private schools, but the public school is the goal. And these people made the schools. Senator Gross in Miami and Goldstein and Samson Weiss in Detroit and people in Chicago and in Kansas City and in Los Angeles. It was all a desert. And people risked their children. And the whole school that I went to, our entry class was 7. And that was boys and girls together. And they were all rabbis' children. It took a while. And then there was the idea, there was a Jew by the name of Rabbi Aaron Cutler. And until then, everybody believed that somehow the American yeshiva student could never follow the curriculum or the rigors or the schedule of the yeshiva system that existed in Eastern Europe, the classical yeshiva system. And Rabbi Cutler, who was the head of Chinuch Hatzmoy, the independent school system in Israel, and Rabbi Cutler was the head of the Vad HaHatzolah that attempted to save Jews during the war. And Rabbi Cutler, who did everything possible on behalf of the Jewish people. So he founded this little yeshiva in Kollel up the turnpike here in Lakewood. I remember in 1953, my father and I came to New York. My father wanted to see Rabbi Cutler. He knew him from Europe, yeah. And we met with him, and my father said to him, There were then 27 students in Lakewood. And my father said to the Rosh Yeshiva, he said, how many students do you think you're going to have here? How many people will be in the kollel eventually? And Baron said, 50, maybe 100. It's 4,000 today. So who imagined such a thing? And the same thing is true in Israel. The first draft of the Israeli army in 1948, there were less than 50 exemptions given to students of the yeshiva. Last year, there were 42,000 exemptions. See, without going into the matter of this touchy subject, but the number itself is astounding. They're not from the days of the Babylonian Talmud have we had such numbers. I'm not speaking about quality, but quantity. Where'd you ever have so many people that are devoted to Torah, who are willing to sacrifice for Torah? And that was because a few people built it. I was a Rav in Miami Beach, so the Satmar Rebbe, the Yoel Teitelbaum, came to winter in Miami Beach. Since I was the rabbi, so he came to pay me a courtesy visit. He got a picture of the scene. I didn't, in Miami Beach, I didn't even have a beard. And he befriended me, did me many, many favors. He was a tremendous individual, a holy individual. Whether you agreed with his policies or not made no difference. You knew you were in the presence of greatness. And he took his people, broken people, all of them refugees, all of them survivors. He built them into an enormous community. And he guided them and he protected them. So there were individuals that saw that there's a potential in American Jewry. For the first 60, 70 years of American Jewry, everybody gave up on American Jewry. Nothing could be. The conservative movement said that it was the wave of the future, and it was the wave of the future. And the famous American Jewish yearbook of 1950, Charles Liebman, the noted sociologist, said that Orthodoxy would disappear in America within a decade. And that only the conservative movement would preserve whatever Judaism would be left. But it hasn't turned out that way. You should never bet against yourself. It's one of the rules. When Theodore Herzl died, so he died penniless. He had spent his entire fortune on the Zionist movement. He never took any salary, and he never even took his expenses. When he died, he was a young man. He was 44 years old. He left a widow and three children, no money. So the Zionist movement, in a fit of remorse, put together a large sum of money to make a trust fund to support the widow and the orphans. At that time, the Jewish National Fund, as today, was selling bonds. The Keren HaYesod, as today, today they call it Israel Bonds, was selling bonds. But the Zionist movement wasn't going to risk Herzl's trust fund, and therefore they bought bonds of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You should never bet against the Jews. Never bet against ourselves. And we have lived to see miracles. Tonight's meeting could not have taken place a few decades ago. Many of you would not have been in the audience. But the prophet told us that there will come a day, v'shalachti rov v'oretz, I shall send forth a hunger in the land. Lo ro'ov lalechem, not a hunger for bread. Jewish community is very affluent, thank God. The problem in the Jewish world is obesity, not starvation. Velo tzomei lamayim, and you'll not be thirsty for water or for anything to drink. You know, all the fine schmeckers on Pesach, you got Spanish wine and Chile wine and Argentinian wine. I remember, you know, the good old Concord grape that after the second coast you couldn't move. You were paralyzed for the rest of the evening. 5 pounds of sugar in every gallon. But we have, you know, Merlot and Riesling, you name it, we're in business. Lo tzomei lamayim, you're not thirsty. Kim lishmoa es dvar Hashem. But I'll tell you what you are hungry for and what you are thirsty for. It's a little godliness in your soul. A little connection to your tradition, a vision for your children and grandchildren. My Rebbe in the yeshiva used to say to us, he said, if your grandparents and your grandchildren are both proud of you, then probably you're a success. I think that that's a pretty good and accurate measure. Well, what will they think of us? If you want to leave them money, no matter how much you leave them, it's not going to be enough. I've been a rabbi a long time. I've sat in on a lot of disputes. I never saw a family of a poor man fight. But you can never leave enough. You just can't. And what will you be remembered as? That's our task, that we want to be remembered. Remembered as somebody that gave them memories. Because that's really all we can give. We want our grandchildren to be proud of us. I know since I became a grandfather, I started to behave myself. I want my grandchildren to be proud of me. And that was always the Jewish way of looking at it. That's what constructed the Jewish world. It's what bound the generations together. And that's what we read in the Haftorah of the great Shabbos that preceded the holiday of Pesach. The Heshiv Levovos Albonim V'Levonim Alavosam. Parents will be proud of children and children will be proud of parents. Be bound together. So how can you be bound together in a world where your cell phone is obsolete 2 months after you buy it? So then that's not the way. And the way to bind together is lishmo es dvar Hashem. There were people who built the miracle for us, and there are those who are the beneficiaries of that miracle. Each and every one of us should try and be from those who build the miracle. To build it in our home, in our family, in our business and profession, in our community, and in the Jewish and general world generally. Yisrael asher b'cho espor, the Navi said. That I'm proud of you, God says, because God is our Father. He wants to be proud of us. And we have that opportunity as perhaps no other generation in Jewish history has had. Our great-great-grandparents would have walked across Europe in the snow barefoot to see any Jewish state in the land of Israel. Who would have believed that the rebirth of Torah would be so real? There would be a Kollel in Philadelphia and Lower Merion? What are you talking about? How could that be? All of this has happened before our eyes. We are all within that miracle. And we have the ability to create better and greater miracles as well. And so therefore, just with that sense of vision and purpose, we can continue and grow and prosper and to raise ourselves physically and spiritually and be a blessing for us and for all of mankind. I'd like to bless each and every one of you individually, my friends. I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here and to meet so many of you. The Lord should bless you with good health and happiness, with nachas from your families, and with inner and external harmony. And we should be privileged together to hear good news always, and be zochah together to nechomas Zion v'inyan Yerushalayim. Amen. Thank you.